I miss a green, for example, I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
Fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
Hello and welcome to the Fried Egg Podcast. My name is Garrett Morrison. I am here today with Andy Johnson. Andy, how's San Francisco?
Revealing my location. It's delightful to be out of winter, and it's cool. It's just nice to be out seeing some golf courses and seeing some stuff and being somewhere where you can do that and not be really cold.
Yeah. Well, it looks lovely. In any case, we are here today to talk about a West Coast location.
Pacific Northwest locations. Shared Pacific Northwest location.
Yeah. Well, is San Francisco in the Pacific Northwest?
Some can say it. Consider it.
Who would say that?
I don't know.
Okay.
It's somebody, you know, intelligent people would consider it. So,
okay.
You know, Midwesterners, naive Midwesterners would consider it.
Anything that's not the Southwest or Southern California is the Pacific Northwest, I think.
Yeah, I think so. That's true. It's if you have redwood trees, you're the Pacific Northwest in my book.
So we are talking about Bandon Dunes, obviously, that little known resort on the Oregon coast. And today is the third of our Bandon deep dives. We've done Sheep Ranch, and the last one we did was Old MacDonald. And today we're going to dig into Bandon Trails, which was the third course that was built at the resort. You know, we're doing these in reverse order, and so that's why we're at Bandon Trails now. Designed by Bill Kaur and Ben Crenshaw, it was built in 2003, 2004, opened in 2005. Some of the associates on this project included Tony Russell, Jim Craig, David Zinkand, Jeff Bradley, kind of a murderer's row of shapers and great architects in their own right. At this point, just to kind of situate people historically with the Bandon Dunes project and where Bandon Trails was in that, Bandon Dunes had opened in 1999 and had been a sensation. Pacific Dunes opened in 2001, I think it was,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And that too was a sensation, right? Immediate entry into, you know, the top 20 in the world. And Bandon Dunes had become a really, really big deal. You know, if you can imagine, when Bandon Dunes just had one course, it was, although it was an incredible course and everybody knew about it, it was just one course way out in the middle of nowhere.
It was like going and finding the great up-and-coming band at a local dive bar that, you know, and then when Pacific Dunes is when they started playing at, like, relatively known locations and on a tour in cities, and then I think, you know, Pacific Trails or Bandon Trails, Jesus, Pacific Trails, Bandon Trails is where, you know, kind of probably it launched the resort into, in the subsequent courses really launched the resort into a whole new stratosphere of superstardom.
That's when they started playing arenas.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So that is the context in which Bandon Trails came about. And I think there was a lot of pressure on it. Right, because Bandon Dunes and Pacific Dunes had been so well received. Both were on the ocean in these spectacular dune environments with great cliff top holes and everything like that. And people knew very early on that Bandon Trails would be a different kind of property. It wasn't going to be on the cliffs. It was going to be inland. There were parts of it that were even going to be in the forest. And so there was quite a bit of pressure on Kaur and Crenshaw to sort of live up to what Bandon Dunes and Pacific Dunes had been. Now, okay, so Bandon Trails was different in a couple of ways. One way, obviously, is that property that I talked about. Another is that Bill Kaur and Ben Crenshaw were very well established at this time in their career in a way that Tom Doak and especially David Kidd were not when they built the first two courses. So by this point, Kaur and Crenshaw had built Kapalua, Sandhills, Friar's Head, Old Sandwich just before Bandon Trails. And so, you know, they were already incredibly well-regarded architects, maybe the best-regarded architects in the world of golf. and here they come to do Trails.
I think it's important to note here that this is the first time that they worked with Mike Kaiser.
Yeah.
Which we then see, you know, they were the first course at Sand Valley. They were, you know, they did Cabot Cliffs, and who knows what, you know, they might do in the future with the Kaisers. But, you know, this started the Core Crenshaw relationship there, which we see more and more of. And obviously they continue to work with Tom Doak and David Kidd. But this was a significant point in terms of them working with the Kaisers and building their most, you know, publicly popular courses, you know, generally come from these big resorts, and the Kaiser resorts are some of the most popular golf destinations. So this is, you know, Coren Crenshaw, you know, Sand Hills and Friar's Head are courses that nobody's going to see. You know, this yeah. this is a golf course that people could go see built by Ben Crenshaw and Bill Core.
And this is really an incredible era for their architecture, because I think most people would agree that Friar's Head and Old Sandwich are both among their best courses. And that is the time in their career when they came to Bandon and built their first Kaiser golf course. And then since then, at Bandon, you mentioned some of the other courses that they've built at Kaiser Associated Properties. They did Bandon Preserve, and then they did Sheep Ranch. And so now at the Bandon Dunes Resort, Coren Crenshaw are the dominant architects. You know, Tom Doak has two 18-hole courses there too, but you know, Kaiser obviously liked what he saw from the Trails project.
As of now, three of the six courses.
All right. So that's all to say that there was quite a bit of excitement about this project and some trepidation on the part of Mike Kaiser, and probably on the part of Coren Crenshaw as well, that, you know, this wouldn't work out as well. It wasn't quite as splashy and exciting seeming as the first two Bandon Dunes courses were, where you had up-and-coming architects and you had these incredible sort of mind-blowing properties right by the sea. You know, where is this new course that's kind of in this forest land area? How is that going to fit into this resort? And so recently you talked to Bill Core, and in fact, this episode just came out a couple of weeks ago. It came out on February 1st, so this is not that long after it. But you talked to Bill Core about Bandon Trails, and he told a great story about essentially how the concept of the course design came about, how they worked out how to tie together the property and some of the decisions that went into that. And we thought we would replay that clip here. Now, if this is really fresh in your memory, then it's about 9 minutes and 30 seconds long, so just skip ahead if you want. But even if you've listened to this once, I think it's really worth listening to again, because to me, it's just so interesting.
The whole thing on Bandon Trails was really illuminating.
Yeah, very much so. Okay, so here's that clip.
Bandon Trails. I'm quite spitting about that place. And, you know, I think it's at the resort, it's got its cult following there among a lot of golf courses that are right on the ocean. And I would love to hear a little bit about the constructing the golf course and connecting those very distinct different areas of the course, the different ecosystems, if you would say, you could say, the ocean, the dunescape ocean holes with the meadow holes, with the forest holes, and kind of how you guys creatively weave that journey together.
Well, Andy, it was Bandon Trails began when Mike Kaiser called, and I remember quite well the telephone conversation. He said, "Bill, I'm thinking about doing a third golf course at Bandon Dunes." He said, "It will not be on the ocean, so you and Ben may not be interested." He said, "But I would just like to have the conversation to see if you might be. And if you are, would you come and take a look at the site?" And I remember then, Andy, I mean, just saying, "Mike, yeah, absolutely. We would love to come see it. I've seen Bandon Dunes. I've seen Pacific Dunes. It's just fantastic. We'd love to do that. And it's not like the site has to be on the ocean. It's not like we have to say, oh, we've got to have the best site. If we can do something that's that you and we and hopefully others will think complimentary to the whole golf experience there, then let's take a look at it. And he said, okay, come on, let's go. And so went out and did look at the site. At that particular time, Andy, Mike, and Howard McKee, you know, McKee's Pub, Howard McKee, who's since passed on, but did all the planning and permitting and everything for Bandon Dunes and for Mike, and was a fabulous architect too, brilliant guy. But they had thought that Bandon Trails would be all east of the big dune ridge back in the forest.
And that dune ridge is the dune ridge that runs through from the hotel, really, the lodge, all the way across, you know, like two at Bandon Dunes plays into it, and then 18 at Pacific Dunes plays along it, and old Mac plays over it on the third hole. So that's the Dunes Ridge, and it'd be east inland of that.
Yes, but it extends down the coast. It's just a giant dune ridge there. And so originally, Howard and Mike said, let's build it back in the forest. It'll be more protected from the wind. And I went out there with that understanding. And I went back and I wandered back there as best you could. It was very hard to get through because of the trees and the gorse and things. There were trails, though. There were both animal trails and a couple of hiking trails that went back through there. And I would just look at it. I went out for a number of days, but each time I was staying in the lodge there at Bandon Dunes, and I would walk out. And each day I would walk out and I'd look at the dunes, what's now number 1 and 18 at Bandon Trails. And there was a trail that I walked on through those dunes, and I walked out through what's now number 5 and number 17, the two par threes there, what we called the meadow area. And then I'd walk and get and go around the bottom end of the big dune and back into the forest. And each day, Andy, I'd come back and I'd go, I could see, I guess, putting it all over here in the forest. And then one day, Mike Kaiser was out there and Howard, and I just remember looking at both of them and I go, you know, guys, this is, after all, called Bandon Dunes. What if we start in the dunes and work our way to the forest? And Mike was going, well, I kind of like that. I might. How are you going to do that, though? And he's like, well, I don't know. But it might be interesting. I said, the more I've walked out there, there's three distinctly different environments. Dunes. Again, what we call the meadow with the beautiful trees and the kinnikinick and the ground vegetation and sand. And then, of course, in the Pacific Northwest forest. And so I'm not quite sure, but I think maybe there could be a way. And Mike said, well, how are you going to get over the big ridge? And I'm not sure about that either, Mike. I said, I know we can go at the bottom end of it where it's much smaller, which is down where 6 green is and 7 tee.
So that was a big linchpin, is
that you could get around that way. It's just how you were going to get back across. And but the more I just wandered out, and Ben came out, and we just kind of, you know, we looked at it, and it just seemed, certainly to me, and Ben was in agreement about this, it could be interesting to tie those three elements, environments, together. And and Mike was so, as he's always been, so supportive. And even though it didn't fit what he was thinking of in the beginning, he was open to it. And Howard McKee, who had permitted everything there, and Howard, whom I just absolutely thought was one of the most amazing human beings I've ever met, talented people. But I would have dinner with Howard quite often, and he'd go, Bill, I don't know. I just don't know. He said, first of all, he said, we're getting ready to dedicate a lot of this dunes area into preserve. And he said, secondly, he said, that area where you go through, you call the meadow. He said, that may be the prettiest property on this entire all abandoned dunes site, you know. He said, I just don't know how you're going to do golf out there. He goes, maybe you could convince me. And Howard, too, was open-minded. And the more we looked at it, and the more we tried to piece some holes together in the routing, he said, all right. I remember distinctly him calling me. They were met me out there where the old road used to go into the main road into Bandon Dunes. You hit over now on the third tee and the 18th tee, and the, Howard and Mike are both going, you're going to play over the main entry road? I go, well, we do it. We've all seen places you do it a lot. And they go, okay, that's okay. But Howard came out there, Andy, and he just said, Bill, you have 1,000 feet. 1,000 feet from this road toward the ocean. He said, that's it. You can't go one inch more. He said, I've talked to the, you know, all the agencies, the state agencies, the county agencies. We can get you that much, that strip of dunes, which is exactly where 1 and 2 and 18 are. He said, so you've got that. Nothing more. And then he looked at me and he said, and if you mess this up in this meadow out here, I'm just going to kill you. He said, this is my favorite place on the entire resort. And I said, Howard, look at this. Because what's now the fifth hole, the little par three, the green was there. You were talking earlier about greens. It was there, the big trough in the middle of it. It just graded it off enough to put some pins on it. The green at 17 was more or less there. And all the stuff in between. So it was like, Howard, we're going to build two par threes in your meadow here. One going this way, one going that way. We'll do very little disturbance. And he goes, okay. So anyway, that's when it linked together. And people say, well, where did the name Trails come from? It came from trails because there were hiking trails out there, particularly through the meadow part, the dunes and the meadow. But then there were animal trails over the big dune ridge and back into the east. So I used to literally walk around all those trails. And so when Mike and everybody was talking about what should the name be, I just go, well, there's just a lot of trails out there. So they said, all right, Band of Trails.
All right, so that's how Bandon Trails became Bandon Trails. Now, one thing I think that didn't necessarily come through in Bill's memory of the construction is that tying together these three environments was a really big concern during the project. They were actually very worried about it. And this is something that comes out in Stephen Goodwin's book, Dream Golf, that you know, I've been mentioning from time to time in these deep dives. They were actively thinking, like, this might not work. We might not be able to do this.
I think that's the thing. Sometimes when you have a golf course that moves into different distinct environments, you can get a feel of disjointedness. And yes, it cannot tie together right, and it cannot blend together right. And obviously, you know, a good example of a golf course that does it really well is one of Bill Coore's favorites, who he's talked about a great deal about the routing, how he is enamored with it, is Cypress Point. Mm-hmm. But then there's, you know, probably everybody here has played a golf course where you all of a sudden are like, God, this is out of the blue. I didn't know this was coming. And I don't know if I necessarily like moving into this environment. And then you go back into a different environment and you're like, that it would have been nice if they could have just had that the whole way around, you know? And I think that's something that a lot of courses face, and tying together different environments. Obviously at Bandon Trails, there's three of them. They have the dunes, the meadow, and the forest, and tying together those parts and making it feel like the same golf course and feel, you know, like a well put together story. It's just like if you're writing something, it's sometimes hard to change topics, right? Mm-hmm. And tie those topics together, back together. They do it so well here. And I think part of it is the way that the golf course starts and ends in one spot and then visits and revisits the different other areas.
Yeah, very successful. and not easy to do. I mean, it seems that when you just play the finished product, it seems like it was easy. It seems like it was natural that it would be this way. But I think it can't be overstated, like, how hard it is to pull this off and do it well. Cypress Point, you mentioned, is an example of a course that obviously does this well. Now, there was another course that was specifically on Mike Kaiser's mind when Bandon Trails was being built as an example of a course where it's not as successful tying the environments together, and it's very close to Cypress Point.
Yeah, Spyglass. So Spyglass is obviously always the victim of this. It's a perfect example of this, is where you play the first five holes and they're spectacular. They're on the ocean, you know, and then the rest of the round, you're climbing up a hill in a forest and there's artificial ponds, and it just, you're just kind of like, oh, that's a different golf course. And I always say it should be just flip the nines. It would get a lot better. Mm-hmm. It would be a lot more coherent of a story because you'd start up in the forest and then you'd play down and then back up into the forest. But like this, that's a good example of a golf course that just doesn't feel together, jointed in its current routing and journey that you go on. Like it wouldn't be the way you, as Bill always says, you know, he talks about routing a course the way you'd walk a course the first time, a property the first time. And I don't necessarily think that'd be the way you'd walk Spyglass, but I certainly think it would be a very similar way you'd walk Bandon Trails.
Right. Now, I think that an underrated part of what makes Spyglass not quite work, and I don't want to dump on Spyglass too much here because I think it's a terrific golf course.
You lived right next door to it for a while.
I know. Yeah. So I lived at Stevenson School, which is a boarding school that literally is right next to Spyglass Hill Golf Course. Stevenson School is right between Spyglass and Poppy Hills. So it was Poppy Hills on one side, Spyglass on the other. And yeah, I was really close to it. And in fact, actually, it's great at Spyglass because there are little trails that go through the course that are public. You can just go walk through that golf course. It's not a problem. And we did it all the time. You know, my kids were young. We'd put them in the strollers and we would be off and taking these wonderfully beautiful walks in the forest, which is an incredible environment. And so, you know, I don't want to say that Spyglass Hill is a terrible golf course. It's really not. It's very, very, very good. But it doesn't quite link up those two different parts of its identity. And I think that one reason for that is that the holes that are in the dunes are different in more ways than the holes that are up in the forest than just the fact that they're in the dunes. The holes in the dunes are shorter, they're quirkier, they just look different overall, the shaping is kind of different, the greens sit in different types of places, the green shapes are very different. You know, the fourth green is this crazy, like, you know, narrow, long thing that You never saw Robert Trent Jones do something like that again. And for some reason, he was inspired to do so in those dunes. But then when you climb back up into the forest, it gets a lot more conventional. And so it really does give you that schizophrenic feeling. Now, at a place like Cypress Point, the holes that are back in the forest or in the dune environment or out on the ocean cliffs do have a sense of unity because the execution of the architecture is similar across those environments. So even if they're in different types of landscapes, they still feel like they're part of the same course.
I think, yeah, I think that there's also like a unifying strategy. They have coherent holes that, you know, kind of fit alongside each other and blend together well in terms of like they, you know, you have the rhythm. And when you go into Spyglass, like you go, it's all those short holes you're talking about, kind of quirkier holes. And then you go back up into the hill and you just feel like you're getting bludgeoned with a hammer. But, you know, it loses some of the kind of up and down nature that some of the really great courses have, where you have a mix of gettable holes and tough holes. And, you know, golf course could be hard. Like this is not, but it's the idea of some flow in it where you feel like you've got some good chances and especially chances if you pull off shots. Like there are holes out of Spyglass where if you hit two great shots, You're just like hoping to make a par after two great shots, you know. Like the eighth hole is one that comes to mind. Like, I don't know what you do there. You're just praying to hit two good shots, and then you might have like 40 feet on a pretty severe green to make, you know. And you know, I think that's kind of what happens. Whereas, like, I think one of the things overarching with Coren Crenshaw that I've noticed is, like, if you hit shots. You get really good scoring opportunities. And I think that's something like where you can really get cooking on Coren Crenshaw courses if you play well. But if you're off, you know, it's going to be a tough day. Like, it's not easy if you're off.
This episode of the Fried Egg Podcast is brought to you by Zero Restriction. So on our trip to Bandon Dunes last November, we encountered all kinds of weather. We played Bandon Trails in torrential rains and gale force winds, and we played Old Mac on a beautiful, clear, but somewhat chilly day. So we needed performance apparel that was really versatile, that could handle anything that the Oregon coast threw at us. Thankfully, we were outfitted on this trip by Zero Restriction. Zero Restriction makes excellent cutting-edge outerwear, and we actually got to try a couple of new items from the ZR collection on this trip, including the Mayweather Pullover and the Wave Hybrid. Both of these pieces have high-tech fabrics that are water-repellent, moisture-wicking, and all that good stuff, and they're nice and stretchy and comfortable. And finally, both items can function really well as either a top layer for a mild day or as a middle layer for those colder and wetter days. You can find the Mayweather Pullover, the Wave Hybrid, and all sorts of other apparel right now at ZeroRestriction.com. And if you use the code OLDMAC at checkout, that's one word, all caps, OLDMAC, OLDMAC at checkout, you'll get 20% off at ZeroRestriction.com. Let's get back to how Trails ties together these different places. Okay, so we've mentioned that there is a coherence to the architecture, whether it's strategy or shaping. Trails has that across the three different areas. But I think that there are other things that make these different environments feel like they're part of the same course. One is the way that the holes are connected with each other and how thoughtful the transitions from a green to the next tee are. And how often those trails between a green and a tee take you from one environment to the next. And so there's kind of a gradual fade or a gradual blend. Think of the trail from the second hole, which is in the dunes, to the third tee, which is starting to be in the meadow with some trees around. You walk off of that second green and you're still in the dunes. You can kind of see what's ahead of you. You can kind of see that there are some trees and a different type of terrain, but that trail just so beautifully, like, gradually fades from dunes to the flora of the meadow environment, and it just makes you feel like they're part of each other. So there are these segues. If we're using a writing metaphor, you need segues between different sections and paragraphs. That's what these trails do.
I think another way you could put it is, like, when you're somewhere where you have a great DJ, they're playing all these different songs, different, you know, sometimes different genres of music, but the way they kind of blend the two songs together at the transition, think of that as the trails at Bandon Trails, where it's that kind of in between the two songs where you get you know what's coming, but you're still finishing out the other song, so you know that's ending and you're going, and it's that in between phase. And that's kind of the way Trails works, with these in between, these holes that go from one area to the next.
Yeah. Okay. So there are the connections between the holes. And then there's the overall sense of coherence in the story of the course in its routing. I've heard you talk about this before. What's your basic take on what the story of this course is?
So I think one of the things with the resort, right, all the holes on the ocean are kind of interconnected, and you're at this resort, and you know you're at the resort when you're at these courses, and you're right there, you're on the ocean, there's infrastructure, there's clubhouses, there's everything. At Bandon Trails, you kind of go out to the edge of this ocean side, and you start, And what it is it's a story of departure. You leave the resort and you go almost, and it's real, you know, as somebody who shot out there, I took a hiking trail, and it is, you go on almost a hike out there. It definitely has the most vertical climb of any golf course out there. And you go up into the forest, but like you're leaving and it's very peaceful. Everywhere else you hear the crashing of the waves on the ocean. At trails, it's silent. And it's really a peaceful place to be, because when you're down at the resort, you see people, you see your, you know, you see other holes. You get up at the top of the of trails and you're isolated, and it's, and you really feel away, and you feel this, you know, departure from this resort that you've been staying in. The resort's wonderful, but it is nice to get away. And I think that's one of the things, trails has got this somewhat cult following. And I think, you know, some people have trouble synthesizing why it's their favorite place. And you get to leave society for a while. And that's really delightful. It's a delightful escapism that it offers guests out there. And, you know, you get to go on effectively what's the most beautiful hike that you could create out there.
It's interesting that the resort sort of feels like civilization now, right? The place where Bandon Dunes is, Pacific Dunes, and Old MacDonald, all of that really does feel like a bustling city at this point. And so Bandon Trails is a departure from that. It is more isolated up there. It is, there's more solitude, and there's this sense that, you know, what you're hearing is no longer other people and vehicles and stuff like that. It's the sounds of nature when you're up there. But just think of when Bandon Dunes was just one course. The whole thing was a departure then. There wasn't this sense of bustle or civilization as much at the resort. And so maybe what the function of trails was that the resort was starting to take on this character of a really busy place, right? You know, Pacific Dunes and Bandon Dunes in the early 2000s were packed just all the time, all day. And so here comes Bandon Trails offering a reprieve from that and a little sense of what the overall feel of the resort was very early in its life. So it's kind of appropriate that Trails came along when it did.
Well, I think that also, you know, I think that leads into some of the real popularity today and how it's grown over time, is that people get there and you're part of the resort, and you know, you're part of this, it's like it's not Disneyland. Like, I'm just to say, like a Disneyland of golf, right? Mm-hmm. And this is the one where you get away and you get, and that's such a nice feeling. And whether, you know, I think that is something that's become more and more part of its identity as the resorts continue to grow after it, because Old MacDonald is definitely part of that bustling system. And Sheep Ranch is a little bit disconnected, but still really part of that system. You can see all the other courses. You get that ocean sound, that ambient noise. I think one of the things that if you go out to trails is the solitude of it.
And away from the ocean is super loud. When you get away from trails, you notice its absence.
Yeah, that's the thing. One time I played a golf tournament at like a state am at Beverly in the city. Uh-huh. And I was there. So I was there for 4 straight days. And it's one of the loudest courses in the country. Like, it's got city roads, it's got a railroad, it's got it's right in the flight path of a major airport. And it's so loud, but after 4 days, you get used to it. And I remember the next day or a day after that, I went to a different golf course and I was like, God, it's so quiet here. You know, and I think that's something that happens with trails, is that it's so distinctly different. That's, I think, the magic of it is for the resort, is that it is so unique to the other courses. Like, the other courses are all different. You know, they have their own identities, but they do sit on ocean dunes. Yeah. They all share a very similar setting. Here, the setting's completely unique. And that is something I think that makes it such a, you know, have such a cult following.
Okay. So you mentioned that it's a story of departure, but then it's also a story of return, right? So it's departure and return. And the key is that you don't start already departed. You start with something familiar. You start in the bustle of the rest of the resort with the two holes in the dunes, with one and two. And then you gradually fade into this sense that you're away and that you've departed by working your way through the meadow and then up back ridge and into the forest, where you stay for seven holes. And then there's a turning point where you launch off of the ridge spectacularly with the 14th hole, but a controversial hole, which we'll talk about later. And you're back in the meadow all of a sudden. And then the story is, you know, kind of gradually fading back into the dunes. And then you fully return there by the 18th hole. So I think the way that the dunes environment at Bandon Trails functions is sort of like a frame story in a movie. And novels sometimes use this device too. And what a frame story is basically a separate set of scenes that take place at a different place in a different time. And often what happens is that the characters in the frame story are telling the story that constitutes most of what you're reading or watching. And so an example of this is like Saving Private Ryan. The frame story is the older Private Ryan in basically the present day, the 90s, when the movie came out.
What a pull.
Right. Going to the cemetery. Do you remember this?
Yeah.
He goes to this. It's the beginning of the movie. That's the beginning of the movie. He goes to the cemetery and then flashes back, remembers, I don't think he's telling the story, but D-Day, right? And the whole movie is set in World War II.
From there.
But then at the end, it goes back to the older Private Ryan at the cemetery. We return there. That's a frame story. It brackets the story. Another example of this is The Princess Bride. Right, with Peter Falk, I think it is, who plays the grandfather, and then Fred Savage as the little boy. And
I'm less familiar with that one.
Princess Bride, really?
I don't know. I'm gonna get you to watch
Princess Bride. It'll be familiar to a lot of people who are not familiar with Saving Private Ryan. I'm trying to cover all our bases here. and so the frame story is the grandfather reading the story to the little boy, and most of the movie is that story that he's reading. Right. And you return there a couple of times throughout the movie, but mainly at the beginning and the end. It is this bracketing frame story. And so for me, the first and last holes at Bandon Trails are like the frame story. Right. This is, we're in a familiar kind of time and place, but we know where we are.
It's almost like a dream.
Yeah. And then we transition. Yeah, the rest of the course I feel like is the dream.
Yeah. It's like you're going to sleep conscious. And you're waking conscious if you thought of it as a dream.
Yeah. No, I love that. I think that's exactly what it feels like. Now, people may think that we're getting a little bit high on our own supply here.
They're going to be wondering what we smoked before this.
This is getting very dorm room. but it really does feel that way. That is what we're trying to explain, is the ineffable feeling of magic at Bandon Trails. This course has it. It has that something that really transports you. And that's why I love it so much, right? That's why I love this course. I don't love this course because it's a collection of the best holes at Bandon Dunes, because it's not. That's Pacific Dunes, you know? I love it because it has this feeling to it that is dreamlike, that is storylike, that's transporting. That's what it does so well.
Yeah, I think that is it. And I think there's some other qualities to it. You know, if you play it in the afternoon, one of the things that you get out there is whether you're a photographer that recognizes this stuff, or you're just somebody that does, you know, you get that unbelievable filtered light through the trees out there that you don't get anywhere else. You get that like kind of misty filtered light in the afternoon out there that adds to that aura, and you're going through this journey, and if you're playing in the afternoon, which I recommend everybody, if you're going to do if you're doing a morning afternoon round, do an afternoon round at Trails, because in the afternoon that afternoon light hits, and it comes through those trees, and it's just like everything turns gold, and it just adds to, you know, if we're going to use dream, it adds to that dream that you're having out there. And it's super neat. I think, like, and what you said is right. Like, when I think about, you know, they have some weak holes at Trails, like, and it's not at all the best collection of golf holes from a golf architecture standpoint on the resort, but it's got the best story of any golf course out there from a storytelling standpoint.
And the holes are really good. And some of them are absolutely great. Like a good half of them, I think you could say, are great golf holes. But there are courses at the resort, Pacific Dunes certainly, but maybe also Old MacDonald, where if you're going hole by hole, if you do that kind of head-to-head thing people do, but what's the best first hole, what's the best second hole? I mean, we did this exercise with the Dream 18, but...
And Trails Finish had so many that just finished second or third, you know, in
people thought we didn't like Trails. When we put out that episode, they're like, ooh, seems like you don't like Trails. It's like, no, it just is not built to do well in this kind of exercise.
Yeah, but if you flipped it and said, how would you split 10 rounds between this course and this course, it would win a lot.
Yes, exactly.
Let's talk about, so we've talked about the Dunes holes. Let's talk about the Meadow holes. That's the next thing you transition. So obviously you move from 2 to 3, and that's one of the cooler transitions of the golf course. You play, you know, to the dramatic par 3 that you kind of plunge down into the bottom of a dune. And then you're down and it enters you into the meadow. I will say this really quickly. If that damn road wasn't there, it would be so much cooler. It already is extraordinarily cool, but it's like what I think one of the coolest moments on property, but it would be so much better if the road wasn't there. And I kind of hate the road. It makes me angry.
No,
every
that's
time I see it.
It's too bad. Yeah. And the road was there before the course was built too. That was the entrance road. And it was a discussion on the design team and with the ownership, like, isn't it kind of weird, guys, that we're building holes like right by our road? You know, what are we doing here? But it certainly wasn't planned that way. There is a different way to get into the resort. There's a road that comes straight out.
Yeah.
It doesn't do kind of this wandering path around that this road does. And you kind of wish maybe that they'd close it down, but that's obviously very much easier said than done. I think
you're going to get the logistics guys on your ass here.
Yeah, you can't. It's not realistic, Garrett. Why are you even talking about it?
Yeah, need to get a big infrastructure talk going. You know, maybe that'll be part deep dive, part 6, abandoned infrastructure.
Really, really deep dive.
We'll bring Tron Carter in as a guest.
Infrastructure Week on the Fried Egg Podcast featuring Tron Carter.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. Let's make it happen. Why not? The Meadow. The Meadow is one of the coolest places ever. I mean, it's just so beautiful there. It is completely unique. The plants that they have around there, I don't know all the names. I think there's one called Kinnikinick, which is a great name for a plant, but there's all these different little things that you see. There's so many different colors and textures. It's just a great place. Bill Corr loved it from the start. He wanted that and had to fight for that piece of land.
Beyond the unbelievable aesthetic that the meadow has, it's so beautiful. The fauna, flora make that, and the trees make that, you know, aesthetic so unique. Beyond having this beautiful aesthetic, as pretty of an inland aesthetic as you could have, it also has some of the best ridges that you could ask for in terms of golf. Ridges that, you know, they worked into the holes to be in very impactful areas off the tee and at greens, where greens sat into, below or on top of these ridges.
Incredible land for golf. And, if we're talking about ridges, there's one that kind of cuts semi-diagonally across the fourth hole.
What's such a great thing about that ridge on the fourth, and it's why it's, you know, I picked the fourth in Old Mac. I sometimes regret that decision for the Dream 18.
I may have talked people into this.
I love the fourth at Bandon. The diagonal nature of it, and Old Mac's is diagonal in a similar way. But what that does, which I think is something really important in the modern game of golf, is it makes long hitters particularly have to hit the ball the right distance and on the correct line. And that's something that Bill Corr talks a lot about. He talked about it in the lead up to Trinity Forest, is the idea of, hey, you know, you're going to have to pick how far you hit it if you want to hit it on a certain line. And there, you know, if you hit it a little too far on the left line, which is safer, you're going to run into the bunkers. Mm-hmm. If you hit it a little too short on the right line, you're going to not get over the hill, or you're going to tumble into the right bunkers. You have to really merge. You know, a great tee shot is different based off of what distance you hit it, which I think is really neat. Like, you know, it's not just one singular line. It is, are you hitting it 300? Are you hitting it 250? Are you hitting it 275? These are all different windows, which is really neat because of that ridge. And then the green sits in a beautiful little pocket.
Which is a theme in this part of the property. The green sites are incredible. The 15th green is one of the great green sites on the resort. That's it just is perfectly kind of blended in there. I don't know how much dirt they moved to make that green.
Bill said it wasn't very much. I think he didn't say it on the pod, but we were talking about it before.
It wasn't very much.
Yeah, it was a green that he brought up himself.
The fifth green I know, which has that big trough through it, was there.
Yes.
That's what Bill says, is that was basically just sitting there, and the discussion was about whether they had to tone it down a little bit because it has big undulations. But that was essentially sitting in the land waiting to be discovered as a green for a short par three, which it is now. The fourth hole, I've come around on this hole. This is not one that I liked initially. I thought it was too hard to get over the ridge. I thought it was just a blind second shot no matter what. But, you know, when I revisited it, I saw that there were these different ways that you could negotiate your way around.
Since you brought up holes that upon first sight sometimes rub people the wrong way, should we talk about another metal hole, the 14th?
I don't think it's just first sight that people don't like this hole on. I think there are people who have seen this hole many times who despise it.
It's so the 14th, you come out of the forest. It's the first hole out of the forest. And obviously you've got the famous bench up there that, you know, Mike Kaiser sat at and
gazed out upon his domain. Yeah. And yeah,
you know, some line that's probably been changed a little bit over the years.
Yeah, maybe
to make
so.
A little bit more dramatic, but yeah.
But it is an incredible view. I mean, you can
incredible.
See why, you know, somebody who came there and looked out at the view of the ocean and the dunes and all the variety of this property might think to himself, yeah, that this should be a place people play golf.
The first time I played Bandit Trails, I played by myself late in the afternoon. This was like the day before the world shut down for COVID. Like, and I was in Bandon. It was the first time I played trails. I teed off like 2 hours before sunset and was just, nobody was out there, and I was just booking it around myself. And honestly, I didn't know where anything was, and I walked from 13 up to 14 to that exact spot. And I just was like, oh my, it was a beautiful night. And I was like, oh my God. And then I read it. So like, I will say I had a similar experience.
The same experience. Yeah.
So I did not know it was
really
there.
Make fun of it. Yeah.
I know. I didn't know it was there, but like, it was like a very similar experience, but it is like, you know, I don't know. It's a little overdramatic.
It's great.
My
well, there's that view. Okay. So that's the view from the tee. It's absolutely amazing. And so you're immediately primed to think that this is a great hole you're about to play, because look at what you're playing off of. But okay, so here's the hole. It sits on a pretty severe side slope. There is a little area on the left where if you place your tee shot there, then you will stay up high and you'll have a shot into the green. But most people's tee shots run down to the right. Okay. And when you're down on the right
spot
and hitting up onto this green, I don't think I've really seen somebody hold the green from down on the bottom on the right. And that's because this green is a tabletop. On the right are bunkers and a severe drop off that goes with the general movement of the land. And then on the left, there is another drop off doesn't go down as far, but there's a definite kind of rejecting contour on the left of this green that goes down into this little gully, and then the land moves back up the hillside. And so people's objection to this hole is, I think, twofold. One, it's too hard to find the ideal position on your tee shot to be up on the left and have a view of the green and a reasonable angle in there. And two, it's just too hard to hold this green. And once you're kind of in various spots around it, you can go back and forth all day. Now, I'm just putting that out there as the argument against this hole. I'm not saying I necessarily agree with it.
Now, I'd say from the left side, if you, I've been in the boat where I've been over left after my second shot. I've been in the boat where I went right off the tee and hit the green. You know, it was a really good shot.
Did you hit the green?
No, this was the first time I played it.
I didn't. Okay.
I've been in the spot where I was in the ideal location and I missed the green from the ideal
Actually,
location.
I remember that wedge. That wasn't your best wedge shot.
It was a horrible shot. But the point, I think, is like if you miss back left, it's a pretty manageable up and down from there for par.
I think so, too. I think that is the best counter argument that you can make that shot from back there.
Yeah. Like if you miss right off the tee, which is the natural place to hit the ball, there's, you know, here's what I like about the hole a lot is that it is a very friendly tee shot if you consider friendly fairway. Like if you think a success of your tee shot is finding the fairway, you're going to love the tee shot. But what I love even more about it is that it is a hole where the fairway isn't necessarily friendly.
No, definitely not.
And that's one of the things. I just think the magic of a golf hole. I think just one of my greatest joys, and I think this comes if you know, I used to play strictly for score really early in my life. And that was what my round and how I thought of things was through a lens of this. And when I stopped caring about score as much because I stopped playing competitive golf, what I started to realize was my favorite things happened when I was playing a course for the first, second, third, and in really great courses for the, you know, if you've played somewhere 10 times and then they still trick you. When you get tricked, it's such a wonderful thing. It's like, oh, I thought I could hit it over there, but I can't. You know, that is a magical feeling, I think. It's hard to feel that way if you're really, really, you know, grinding on score, on your personal score. And I think this is a hole that's so brilliant because they give you all the room in the world over there. And it's super short. You can make a two here if you're a long hitter. It's two is in the cards. But if you out of position, four is going to be very, very hard to make.
Well, so I don't know if this hole necessarily tricks you, does it? I think it's pretty clear to most people what you need to do. You need to try to stay up left. But it's just really hard to do that.
Here's the thing, though, is you know that the only place you can really ruin the hole in your mind is left, is if you hit it left.
And if you go into the forest on the left.
In the forest on the left. And it's just like the, almost like that famous hole at Woking, the fourth, right? With the railroad and the centerline bunker, uh-huh. Right? Here they have a ridge right in the center of the fairway, right? That ridge then pushes you further and further offline. But if you play along the railroad at Woking, at a boundary line, so just think of the left as out of bounds, it's going to be hard to find your ball over there. And they give you all the space in the world, right? I mean, you can hit a really bad shot right, and it still finds that fairway over there on 14. And, you know, they give you all the room in the world over there. And in whether you or not you admit it, subliminally what happens is people bail out. You know, it's very hard to get yourself to hit it up the left. And that's where, you know, whether or not people admit it, they chicken out a lot and they bail right. And you face the penalty for bailing right. And what people get upset about is that they can't hit the green from the fairway from 40 yards. Mm-hmm. And you shouldn't always be able to, especially on a 320-yard hole or whatever the yardage is. The yardage is irrelevant, right? You know, if you can hit it up there that close, there should be some penalty for being in a very, very bad position.
Yeah, and if we're talking about course management, if you're down on the right, what you need to do is have a club or a distance where you know you're going to be long, you know, where you're not going to be short in the bunkers on the right, because that's really, really dead. And you can hit that shot. Now, I think that over time they have softened that green a little bit. So maybe the recoveries are easier than they used to be. And maybe some people form their impression of the hole earlier on when the green was more severe, apparently.
The hole is really similar to 10 at Riviera.
Yeah, but so much more extreme in its land.
The land is what the Riviera has, the extreme bunkers and more extreme green contours.
And really hard to hit from the right.
Yeah, it's the same thing, though. It's the same concept.
Yep.
You know, if you can hit it pin high left, you're gold. It's just you know, at Riv, you've got palm trees, like palm tree bushes that you could get in. Here, you've got a forest.
Here's the difference between 14 at Bandon Trails and 10 at Riviera. And that's that it's a much more common outcome on the 10th hole at Riviera that a player ends up left of the green.
They don't have out of bounds.
They don't have out of bounds on the left. You have room on the left, and you don't have the whole fairway pushing your ball to the right. So it's a much more common outcome to be up the left. And I think that's the argument. I think that a lot of people have against trails is that if you're thinking about the percentage of times that the outcome is that you're up on the left and you have the ideal angle, it's pretty rare. That said, I saw you up there once, and I've been up there once, the first time I played trails. So it does happen. And so the question is, like, what percentage is acceptable? You know, if we're talking about a hole where there's an ideal side of the fairway or angle, at what point does it become a bad golf hole because that outcome is too rare? And I don't know. I think it's an open question. I think that if every hole at Bandon Trails were like this, it would be a problem. But personally, I don't have a big issue with it being the one hole on the course that's kind of like this.
The other thing I like about it is it introduces an extremely high variance in scoring without a ton of lost balls. It does this without like a huge water hazard in front of the green, like an island green. It creates a extreme, like if you get out of there with a birdie, you know, if you're playing in a foursome, somebody's making a five or a six, you know, and it's a short hole. And I just think that it's, I think sometimes, like if you think about like a golf course as a, you know, golf course is kind of like a defender, right? The 14th is kind of like your Bruce Bowen. He's like, you're the guy that's just like,
is it your Patrick Beverly?
Yeah, he's jabbing at your sides. He's your chippy. It's the chippy defender that gets under everybody's skin at one point.
Yeah, it's the P-Bev.
And it's just it's just an irritator, you know. And some people can have a wonderful time and have no problem. Like people have games where they have no problem with Bruce Bowen and torch him. But then there's some other days where they just get under their skin and get, you know, and I think that's the way you got to think of this. Is it's like it's the guy that you want on your team, but you don't want to play against.
Yeah. And the guy, when you play against this kind of player, you think you should be able to take advantage. I mean, Bruce Bowen wasn't the most athletic player in the world, right?
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people have the same reaction to the 14th hole. We just compared a golf hole to Bruce Bowen, by the way. Why am I not doing well on this hole? It's a short par four with a hugely wide fairway. It's drivable in a lot of situations when the wind is going the right direction. How am I taking a seven here? You know, that's the feeling. Okay, so Bandit, we should probably talk about, we've spent 20 minutes now on 14 at Bandit Trails, but
the forest holes.
The forest holes.
Or do you want to talk about the crossing? Because the crossing's cool too. 5 and 17 in the meadow holes at Bandit Trails, one of the best spots in golf.
14 is an interesting hole to talk about because there's a debate about it, but I don't see any argument that 15 isn't just an incredible, wonderful golf hole. Same with 5 and 17 and 3 and 4.
6 is cool. I think 6 is a cool hole too.
6 is so cool. High, low fairway. Very subtle green. Probably the flattest green.
Very hard green to hit because of the angle, especially if you're on the low side, on the left side.
Now, 16 is definitely not one of my favorite holes. That's one where I actually think this is not a very good golf hole. It's a par five that just goes straight up a hill.
Seven fits into that boat too. The hard holes out there are the ones that go up the hills.
And there may be holes that you, especially the first time you play them, you might not remember much about them. You might remember that 16 goes straight up a hill, but I think 9 and 10 also are ones that don't stick super firmly in the memory.
Come on.
12.
9. I love 9. I just love the green. I love the back there, all in the trees. I think the ridge off the tee on 9 is cool. I think you're shortchanging 9. I enjoy 9.
I'm just saying it's not a hole that you remember particularly after your first time playing it.
I think that's like the most peaceful spot. Like you get back there or 11, that or 11. You know, the 9 and 11 stick out to me as two places where, like, I kind of pinch myself as to, like, God, is this really, you know, I think the weakest holes at Trails probably are the forest holes in general. But I will say that, you know, the meadow's probably my favorite, but the forest part is where I feel, like, the most alive.
Yeah, I mean, I was working through all the holes that might be considered less than absolutely exceptional to get to holes like 8, 11, 13 that are incredible.
Yeah, I don't know. I think the meadow's probably to be the best golf holes, but I love the forest holes too. I just love that getting up to the top, you know, you climb up on the seventh and, you know, I think the seventh is a decent hole and you get up there. And then I think that being up there, you feel that like sense of accomplishment that you've almost made it to the top. And then you get to just explore back there in the forest. And I think one of the things for me being somebody not from the Pacific Northwest is like, that's such a unique type of golf and just setting for golf with those big trees. And the 11th is so cool too. The green site down by the pond, that's just like, and it's so fun looking back up the hill and having that, you know, it's just such a gargantuan, you know, like feature that goes through it, that ridge that you tee off over. But yeah, I agree. It's like in every other hole course in a way where like, you know, like it has like these like just absolutely spectacular holes. And then there's some holes that, you know, aren't spectacular, but they're still very good.
There's usually at least one thing, a couple of things about each hole, even the less memorable ones, where when you play it a second, a third time, you discover it and you say to yourself, that's really clever or that's really fun. Okay, so that's Bandon Trails. We should probably start wrapping this up. As a kind of closing thought, something that I think is remarkable about the history of this course and kind of how the idea developed as it got designed is that there was a time when they were working with this property at the very beginning when Mike Kaiser and Kemper Sports, which manages the resort, were thinking that Bandon Trails might be the first course where they would introduce golf carts. They were considering that because you can see why. It's a pretty extreme property. It's a tough walk. It's spread out. And so they were considering maybe offering golf carts for this course. They ultimately chose not to. And I think that was such a great decision because this course is really a tribute to the beauties and the wonders of walking. It's everything that's wonderful about taking a walk, or you could even call it a hike. The things that you discover along the way, this is something that Bill Kaur talks about all the time. You know, he and Ben Crenshaw are all about walking. They walk everywhere when they are exploring a site. They don't take their vehicles. They walk and look and talk and walk and look and talk. And this course, more than just about any other, I think, brings forward that part of golf.
Yeah, golf carts would have really taken away from just the whole journey.